Hello, I'm Jonathan Overend. Welcome to episode 3 of Sport and the Fields in association with Aldi UK, official supermarket partner of Team GB. Now, what's going to be really interesting, I think, about this episode, when we consider all the radio or the audio content we'll have listened to over the last few months, every part of that recording process, the speech, the mixing, the editing, the whole production process, it hasn't come from a glitzy studio on the whole. Because of the situation, it's come from bedrooms, it's come from offices, it's come from studies, conservatories, living rooms, sheds, garages. I'm in my bedroom at the moment, for example. It's become a little bit of a way of life in the industry. Now, it does two things. One, yeah, it saves money. But two, you undoubtedly miss out because you're not there. And in sports broadcasting, when we talk about being there, we mean pretty much in the front row of some of the greatest moments in history. And that's what we're trying to get across in this series. I'm going to welcome on this episode two people who I consider absolute legends of the sports broadcasting business. And they have been there. They have been there for decades and have got so many great experiences and so many great stories to tell. So settle back, enjoyed some time in their company. Welcome to Sport and the Fields. Well, my co-host for this episode, and I'm delighted to welcome him onto the pod as part of the team because I think it would be fair to say that over many, many years, he set the absolute gold standard in the industry that we're lucky enough to work in, and he's John Inverdale. Hi, Invis, how are you?
Well,
I won't.
I'm overwhelmed. No. I have no desire to be part of this. Goodbye.
you're not allowed to argue back either. But look, you've been to every Olympic game since 1988, I'm guessing?
Yeah, I have. I mean, I think the Olympic Games are the single most amazing sporting event in the world, you know, bar none. And I think it's always interesting to sort of cast your mind back, which inevitably you do a lot more as you get older, about where it was that, if you like, the flame was lit as far as you were concerned about the Olympic Games. Mm. And I mean, I was brought up overseas. We didn't have a television living in Singapore or Malaysia, and I didn't really listen to the Olympics. I don't remember at all. But I do recall Bob Beamon and the Black Power salutes in Mexico.
68.
But I think what really caught me was Munich in 72, inevitably the terrorist attack, and seeing David Coleman for hours on end holding together this live, unbelievable unravelling of events in the context of a major sporting event. I mean, again, I'm sure we'll come onto this at other points, but you know, anybody who thinks that sport and politics don't mix is just living in a fantasy world, because sport is one of the great arenas for political statements, for political showboating, for whatever it might be. And here it was, writ large, in Munich. And I just remember being just transfixed, just watching it for hour after hour after hour, amazed at what was happening in this sporting arena. Mm-hmm. And then 4 years later, I remember, you know, watching Montreal and also, if, you know, nothing in a sense to do with the sport, although I will never forget Brendan Foster's bronze medal, largely because we didn't win an awful lot else. You know, the idea that 30 years later we were still talking about Montreal because they were still paying the debt off. I mean, this is from the top of my head. I think it was six times the cost that it should have been, that it actually ended up being. And Canada was still footing the bill 30 years after 1976. I mean, that is absurd. And of course, the Montreal Games, sorry, just going off on a sort of little tangent here, but of course, that was politically tarnished as well, because the African nations didn't take part because the New Zealand rugby team had gone to play against the Springboks and the IOC wouldn't sling New Zealand out, so the African nations withdrew. Then 4 years later you had Moscow and the Americans weren't there. Then 4 years after that you had LA, and you know, but I have to say, probably from a jingoistic point of view, if you like, those games will always be kind of Seb Cohen, Daly and Steve Ovett, because they were such huge individual characters that transfixed a nation and really took you so far beyond just the sporting arena. And then suddenly in 88 I was going, and I thought, oh my god, all these games I've watched, and now you've got to go.
And we'll talk about Seoul throughout this episode with our guest who's joining us in just a moment, but I'm interested in, after that, John, Barcelona, Atlanta, Sydney, Athens, Beijing, London, Rio, I mean, So, I mean, what does that mean? Eight Olympic Games, eight Summer Olympics in a row that you've been to. What is the vision that when you wake in the night with Olympic rings over your head appears in your mind?
Barcelona. I've got a very long story that involves Simply Red and Barcelona. If later in the series you're short of something to talk about, it's actually quite a good tale.
The whole of Simply Red or just Mick Hucknall?
No, actually the whole of Simply Red. But Barcelona to me means, Barcelona to me means Terry Wogan. Because he was Karen Keating and myself were the sort of the three anchors for BBC Radio there. And 2 years earlier, actually, at the Football World Cup in 1990 in Italy, we'd all stayed in this unbelievable hotel. I mean, they could have staged the damn tournament in my room. It was so big. And I was fit in those days, I used to go for a run round my room. It was just, I didn't need to go outside. It was ridiculous. Anyway, it was decided, rightly so, that this height of extravagance really couldn't be tolerated at future major events. So I remember going to Barcelona and going into the hotel, pushing the room door, and it hit my bed. And you could only access the toilet and the bathroom by climbing over the bed. That was, we had gone from one extreme to the other. And I remember we'd all arrived, you know, about a week or so before the games, and we all went down to the bar and said, God, what is Terry Wogan going to make of this? Because he was, you know, not just one of the greatest broadcasters ever, but at that time he was the absolute master of everything. Mm-hmm. And the fact that he was coming out effectively to captain our team was overwhelmingly inspiring for all of us, and boy did it make everybody else up their game, by the way, which is a very, very interesting, you can say that in a sporting context, but you can say it in, in a broadcasting context as well. So the days went by and everybody was getting ready for Terry to arrive, and we noticed that there were painters and all sorts of workmen that were rushing along the corridor. And they were literally giving Terry's room a complete makeover. And it was barely bigger than the one I had. And we were all saying that there was almost a book being run on when Wogan arrived, whether he'd go up to his room, come back down with the suitcase that he'd gone up the stairs with, and say, you know, I'm not bloody doing this, and just go. But the mark of the man, that he arrived, went up to his room, dropped off his suitcase, came down the stairs, walked into the bar where we were all waiting with bated breath, thinking, what's he going to say? And he just said, well, it's not the Ritz, but who wants a drink? And he was the best tourist ever. And so for all the magnificence of Montjuic and everything else, just how Terry Wogan, in our little world, as an absolute superstar, how he conducted himself and was one of the team was a lesson, I think, that anybody who was there learnt an awful lot from.
So eight Summer Olympics, few can surely touch that, John. And we're going to be joined now by a man who remarkably is still going, remarkably in one sense because he's such a legend of our industry, not remarkably in another because he's still very much at the top of his game, but a man that you've known for decades, John, the man who commentated on the Ben Johnson Classic 100-metre final in Seoul. Just tell us a little bit, perhaps for our younger listeners, about Mr. Ian Dark.
Well, Ian Dark is one of the greatest commentators that British sport has had the privilege of having, actually, for the last 30 or 40 years, in terms of football, which most people will hear him doing nowadays, but in terms of athletics, and also, actually, if it's sparing Ian's blushes, as a boxing commentator, he was without parallel. You know, he saw the punch coming before it hit, and you could almost hear him. If you were listening on the radio, you'd hear him say, Bruno looking for the uppercut. And at that moment, you would hear the thud of the glove on the chest. And you thought, this is a guy who knows his onions. He's a master of his craft.
I'd wake in the night in my early teens to listen to those Vegas fights. And it would be this man at the mic. But we want to talk to him about his Olympic experiences. So let's bring him in without any further ado. It's Ian Dark. Well, hello, Ian. Great to speak to you, sir. How are you? How are you finding lockdown in Shea Dark?
Very strange, just reduced to a series of Zoom calls and trying to call Bundesliga games from my office with the picture freezing from time to time. Pretty scary stuff, in fact.
I'm watching Ian, I haven't missed a single game.
Really? You must have been bored, so you caught Hoffenheim v Hertha Berlin. I bet you were hanging on every second, John.
But that was a very dubious penalty right at the end, I thought. I really do.
Yeah. I might not have known, because one guy was taking a corner and the picture froze, and the next thing I saw was the ball with the goalkeeper in his hand. So get out of that.
This sort of low-budget stuff wouldn't have been allowed at the BBC in the 80s, would it?
Oh, I don't know. Don't give them ideas.
But it is amazing, seriously, though, isn't it, that you could be coming out of my television in the south of England talking about a German football match which is happening live somewhere in Hamburg or wherever, and you are in your study or wherever you happen to be.
It really is, and somehow we did make it work in the end, but heaven alone knows how, because, I mean, the thing is, and the problem, just being serious for a moment, is I think that it's going to give bosses the idea that we can do this all the time, rather saving hotel bills and aeroplane fares when you're operating at a huge disadvantage, I think, as any commentator would know, by trying to do it that way.
And if you go back actually to the early days of cable and satellite television, you know, where a lot of things were done off tube, I do recall Jeff Stelling famously doing something for Eurosport, I think, where he'd done a football match when he wasn't at the stadium. And then somebody was ill and they asked him if he could just stay on and do the show jumping from Aachen in Germany. So he literally had just said goodbye from wherever he was doing a football match, and he reappeared after the ad break going, "Hello and welcome to Aachen for the Grundus," whatever the hell it was, you know.
Which is why I think this series might be quite useful, because it's going to remind everyone, particularly those younger listeners, of the benefit of being there. And you've both got vast experience over the years of being there and being able to inform your commentaries and inform your programmes with stories of people you've met and little tidbits that you've picked up behind the scenes. And Ian, this is what we want to get from you, specifically about Seoul 1988. But before we get there, let's head to California, shall we? Los Angeles 1984 and those really impressive games. What's your overriding memory from arriving in Los Angeles, first of all? You were there for the boxing, weren't you?
Yeah, I was covering the boxing at that time, and I was still pretty much a rookie boxing commentator feeling my way. I'd only done it for a couple of years, but I had been to America. I'd covered Muhammad Ali, was the first fight I ever covered, against Larry Holmes, one of the saddest events I've ever been at. So I kind of knew what it was like going to America. But Los Angeles, it was exciting because there was a feeling you were among the chosen ones. We were much younger and much more wide-eyed, and I remember being very, very excited. I was first of all sent to San Diego. I wasn't covering the athletics, but I got the job somehow. Derek Mitchell, who was our editor at the time, sent me there to interview all the athletes, Dave Moorcroft, Alan Wells, just lounging around in the pre-training camp. The only problem was Derek had arranged it with Frank Dick, the director of coaching, but he hadn't told the athletes. So they were pretty annoyed that this guy had turned up trying to interview them all while they were trying to relax and get themselves mentally ready. So that wasn't very easy. And then it was off to cover the boxing in the Coliseum. And John will remember, I think the Coliseum is in a dangerous part of L.A., a very dangerous part of L.A. And I remember the first time I went, because the boxing was right next door to the Coliseum, standing out on the street afterwards, waiting for a BBC car. We had such things, such luxuries in those days. And a policeman on a motorcycle coming up to me and saying, "You're not going to hang around here long, are you, sir?" And I said, "Well, why, what's the problem?" He goes, "Because you won't be here for long if you stay much longer. I'm going to stay here till your car arrives." So it wasn't a smart part of town to hang around in.
I have to say, Darkie, I hadn't realised you did Ali against Holmes, because I'd always felt the one thing that I had on you, the only thing I had on you, was that I'd seen Ali fight live when perhaps you hadn't. How many fights of his did you see?
Yeah, just that one. I mean, really? I wish I'd been around for the Rumble in the Jungle. Jungle and The Thriller in Manila and all that kind of thing. All the boxing writers who had been there told me all the stories from those fights. But, I mean, being there at that fight in Las Vegas was immensely sad. I always remember a guy behind me because, you know, Ali got beaten up, didn't he, for 10 rounds by Larry Holmes. And he did fight once after that, but he was a shell of himself. The fight should never have happened. And I remember a guy behind me crying in the crowd. And I remember reporting this on the Today program and saying, please don't do this anymore, Ali. You're breaking my heart. And he was in tears. And that kind of captured the moment. So, yeah that was my first ever assignment in America. Ali, it's all been downhill from there, really.
Yes. No, I went backpacking around America in the late 70s and happened to be in New Orleans when Ali fought Leon Spinks at the Superdome. And I genuinely bought the T-shirt. I still, to this day, have the T-shirt which had the third coming on it. And I always thought, and you never really, I mean, at the time, how could you possibly have known? But to be able to say that you fought, that you saw Ali fight live is one of the great things that, you know, those of us who've had that chance. Yeah. I mean, I was in the you know, Rose Double Z 273, and I could barely see anything, but what an amazing memory.
I mean, my great memory from LA, the 1984 Olympics, I was sitting there every day watching the boxing. And of course, Lennox Lewis was fighting. He was fighting, you know, for Canada then. I think he got to the quarterfinals, no more. Mike Tyson never made it. And the heavyweight was Evander Holyfield. For the United States. He got disqualified. But what I noticed was, sitting around every day, that Jack Nicholson was sitting in the front row at the boxing. And I thought, that would be a useful interview. He must be really into this. So after about 3 days of this, I thought, I'll pluck up courage. They were trying to stop me getting anywhere near. So I went over to Jack Nicholson and shouted across to him, because I couldn't get that near, and said, would you be prepared to come and do an interview for BBC Radio, Jack? And he said, sure, where are you? So I said, I'm up here, about 10 rows back. So he wandered up and was about to do the interview with us, that which they were going to record back at Broadcasting House. This is Jack Nicholson sitting next to me. And a voice in my headphones said, oh, BBC World Service would like you to commentate on this next fight between the Tanzanian and the Somalian. So I had to say to Jack, listen, I'm ever so sorry. Could you just hang on for a few minutes? I've got to cover this, commentate on this fight. He goes, sure. He started using my name. He said, sure, Ian, go ahead. I'm listening. It was just like in the movies. And so I had to commentate on this very dull contest for the next 10 minutes. And then we got the Jack Nicholson interview done. I've still got the boxing program from LA signed by him.
Oh, that's fantastic. But talking about people doing ridiculous things, boxing things as well, Don King of that ilk came in to do a show that I was doing for Radio 5 in days gone by. And he happened to be there when the traffic person came in to do the traffic news. And he said, and he was in for an hour. So there'd been a travel report at 15:15, and there was going to be another one at 15:45. So anyway, the traffic news came and went, and we played a record. And during the traffic news, or rather, sorry, during the record, Don King said to me off air, he said, I'd like to do the travel news. And I said, really? He said, really? So half an hour later, it got to 6:15. I said, and now with the travel news, here's Don King. And I remember his first words were, on the Alpha One. near Bedford. Fantastic.
And anyway, Jack Nicholson ended up doing that interview, did he?
He did the interview, yeah. And I'll tell you what, he was so well briefed. He'd done his research and he knew all about the Coe-Ovette rivalry, and he was talking about other British athletes and their chances. And this, he knew sport back to front, which is, I guess, was why he was sitting there locked on the boxing every day. The other thing I remember about LA was we stayed at the Ambassador Hotel, which was quite eerie, because that was the place where Bobby Kennedy got assassinated. So that was a kind of spooky thing, which we talked about quite a lot at breakfast, I seem to recall.
That's superb. And I tell you what, you know, we started this conversation talking about the dangers of covering sport from our living rooms, as everyone has been doing in the last few months. Well, there you go. I mean, there's evidence. You wouldn't have had Don King doing the travel news and Jack Nicholson on the air, would you, if you hadn't been there?
Exactly. Tell that to the executives.
you wanted me to ask you about your Tessa Sanderson story, Ian. I fear we might be here well into the afternoon, but go for it. What happened?
Well, I'll keep it very, very brief. So the boxing had finished one day, and I mean, I love athletics, so it was right next door. I had the accreditation, so I thought I'll wander in and see the athletics for a bit. And I wandered up to see Alan Parry, who was the commentator then with Peter Matthews. You won't believe it when you think how many people the BBC sent to the Olympics now, but they were the only two people covering the athletics in the stadium for the BBC. So I said to them, "Well, what's gone on today?" They said, "Oh, we got a gold medal. Tessa Sanderson's won the gold medal." I said, "What? Has she?" I said, "What did she say afterwards?" I said, "What did she say in the interview?" He said, "Oh, we haven't had a chance to go down and interview her. We've been carried on doing the commentary. There was no reporter." So I thought, "Well, I've got my year." I said, "I'm going to go and find her and get an interview. We've got to get an interview with her." So I wandered down, and I found where they were doing the press conferences, and she was finishing the press conference, and she didn't really want to talk about it, quite weirdly. It was like, she said, I went up to her afterwards and said, "Can I do a piece with you for BBC Radio?" She said, "No, I don't really want to. You know, I want to be humble about it. I don't want to do it." I said, "You've got to do it." It's the only time I think in my whole career I've said, "You have to speak, Tessa. You can't let the moment pass without talking to the nation about what you've just done." So she did it, and she was delightful. But that was the first time I'd ever got anywhere near athletics. But there would have never been a Tessa Sanderson interview had I not just wandered into the stadium on the off chance.
That's amazing, isn't it? How things change, John. You know, these days they leave the track. They probably have to do about 50, don't they?
Yeah.
Walking through
mixed zones. Yeah, exactly. She'd have been led to microphones, wouldn't she?
This is Sport in the Fields in association with Aldi UK, official supermarket partner of Team GB. And we're talking to Ian Duck, who before the 1988 Olympics became the BBC's main athletics radio commentator. So he headed to Seoul, South Korea, knowing that he would be calling all the big races. Little did he know what was to come. So how did he feel about that assignment?
Quite nervous. I don't think broadcasters are normally nervous. That's not the right word. It's supposed to be a kind of controlled adrenaline. But if I'm being blatantly honest about it, I think I was a bit nervous because I knew that race in particular, Ben Johnson against Carl Lewis, the big showdown in the 100 metres, was the centre point of the whole Olympics. It had had a massive build-up. And you're thinking, I've got to get that right, and I'll have 10 seconds to get it right, and it could be a vest-thin finish, which will be hard to call. And if you call the wrong winner, or you get something wrong, or you miss the fact that Linford Christie's made a late run and got a bronze medal, which is what happened in the race itself, of course, later elevated to silver, which we all know about. But, I remember feeling, I've got to get this right. I've got to get this right, and I've got about 30 words to do it in those 10 seconds. So there was that trepidation, but I remember doing a mountain of preparation for that Olympic Games to make sure I was on top of everything and I'd given myself the best chance.
You were on the team as well, John, weren't you? What was your role?
Well, I went out actually 3 weeks before the Games began as the news reporter, because I think the thing that people forget, Olympic Games are the greatest example of soft power being used as a sporting mechanism in the world, I think, in a way. And this was South Korea announcing itself to the world. And no Olympic Games, in my memory anyway, have ever in advance gone according to plan. So there were massive student riots in Korea in the run-up. Do you remember this, Darkie? In the run-up to the Games.
Yeah, I do.
And I actually wrote a couple of letters to family saying, if I don't come back, you know, it's been quite fun. Because I was scared. I'd never found myself in that kind of situation before. So I was doing all that for 3 weeks or so. And then got asked if I wanted to go up to the demilitarized zone between North Korea and South Korea. And I think only about half a dozen of us went in this bus. And standing up there, looking at, you know, these North Korean rifles 2 miles away or however far away they were pointing in this direction, I just suddenly realised the history of that part of the world, because you're only 30 years after the Korean War, and realize that this was a major political statement by an emerging power in Southeast Asia. And then going back to the International Broadcast Center and it all building up to the 100-meter showdown.
It was kind of overshadowed by the whole Johnson-Lewis verbal slanging match that went on before the Olympics, where Carl Lewis was just saying that Ben Johnson was a drug cheat and he shouldn't be there, because Johnson kept beating Carl Lewis. He'd done that at the World Championships in Rome a year before. So the whole thing became like a bit of a giant whodunit with drugs, especially when the Johnson story broke in the way that it did.
There was a brilliant book about that race written by a guy called Richard Moore, and in it he was saying exactly that Carl Lewis had been doing these interviews, yeah. He'd been talking Johnson down, he'd basically been putting the scandal out there before it actually took place. He did very, very specifically, and didn't he, suggest that Ben Johnson was taking drugs?
He did. Well, Ben Johnson looked like he was taking drugs. Let's be honest about it. He had bulging eyes and he'd muscled up immensely. His times had gone through the roof. But, you know, that book you talk about is called The Dirtiest Race in History. They made a good film about it. Mm. We later found out Ben Johnson was on rocket fuel. And I remember how this happened, because we'd all gone for a drink. There was going to be a rest day in the athletics. We'd covered the first half of it. We were in the bar in the hotel. We're in a very nice hotel. And we were in the bar. And I'll be honest with you, we'd had quite a lot to drink because we had a rest day the next day. So we'd gone to bed. I'd gone to bed about 2 o'clock in the morning. All the boys and girls were down there, gone to bed. About 4 or 5 in the morning, my phone rang in my room. And it was Mike Lewis, our editor. And he said to me, "Wake up now, Darkie," he said. "Write down what I'm going to tell you. Don't say a word. You're going to be on the 5 to 10 sports desk back home in 2 minutes from now." And he quickly gave me, "Ben Johnson's failed a drug test. He's on the next plane out of Seoul. It's anabolic steroids. He's been disqualified. Carl Lewis is getting the gold medal. That's all you need to know for the first piece. Get on, put the phone down." In the next second, Gary Richardson rang me from London, and I was, you know, I was awake by now, because this was 10 on the Richter scale, wasn't it, as a news story. Yes. And I did this piece just from those notes I'd written down from Mike Lewis, and tried to make sense of it in a voice piece, knowing, and John will appreciate that, and I'm sure you will, Jonathan, as well, you just get a time in your life as a broadcaster, it doesn't happen often, where you're thinking, I am about to deliver news which is going to have everybody in the country talking. They're all going to be on the phones to each other saying, "Have you heard this?" It was as apt a sensation.
But I tell you something, Darkie, my part in that, very small though it was, actually was exceeded by the part my sister played in this.
Ah!
Because she rang me at 10 to 4 in the morning, forgetting about time zones, to say, "Hey, isn't it amazing about Ben Johnson?" And I answered the phone going, "What about him?" "Well, he's failed a drugs test." I went, "What?" So in my pyjamas, I ran down the corridor in our hotel, knocked on Mike Lewis's door, who came to the door in his pyjamas and said, "John, what on earth's going on?" And I said, "Mike, Ben Johnson has failed a drugs test." And he went, "Oh, my God." And obviously then immediately went and rang you.
Yeah. What an incredible story. And, of course, the whole thing only broke. I mean, they would not have announced it, but for the fact that the guy working in the laboratory who did the test had a mate who worked on the China Morning Post. Do you remember that, John?
Yeah, yeah.
And he rang his mate and said, "I've got Ben Johnson's drug test here. He's failed."
Yeah.
And that's how the story broke right in the middle of the Olympic Games.
Never knew that, and I've always wondered that, Ian, because, of course, these days, if you fail a drugs test, you know, you have to sort of almost appeal against it first, mm-hmm. don't you? And then the appeal gets heard, and then it gets made public if you're found guilty. And that can take months and months and months and months. I've always wondered why this came out only 2 days after the race.
And it's also important to put it in the sort of context, the geopolitical context as well, that we were used to the rumours about East Germany and Russia and all that sort of stuff. But there was this guy's from Canada. You know, they're nice, fluffy people from, you know, the hinterland of North America. They don't do this kind of thing. So it really did feel very different. It felt as though the drugs world had moved its axis into another sector of sport. And it then did make you think, well, if the Canadians are involved in this, where should we be looking now? Is everybody on it? You know, did take it on another step.
Even to this day, that story remains the signature drug story, doesn't it, Ben Johnson? And I don't think he's ever come to terms with that. I think he's still in denial and thinks, well, they were all on it and I did it better.
Can we just rewind to the night of the final, Ian? 24th of September 1988. You mentioned earlier how Carl Lewis had been stoking the rivalry and had been talking Johnson down and been putting it out there that he was a drugs cheat. What did you think when everyone lined up for that 100 metres final, and specifically when Johnson crossed the line in what was an extraordinary time of 9.79 seconds?
Well, I think I described it at the time because I've heard the clip replayed many times, even to this day, as sensational, superlative running, which on the face of it was. You had to take it there as a kosher run. We'd have the debates later about whether he'd been on rocket fuel, how it had all happened. I think it was the first big final ever where there were four runners under 10 seconds. It was an incredible race. I mean, really, if I'm honest with you, all I was thinking about was calling the race correctly. There's enough on your plate with that. So I had no thoughts other than just calling the race, knowing that clip of that 100 metres would be used many, many times and down the years. So my concentration was only on getting it right.
Did you look instantly at the clock to see the time when he crossed the line? Did you know it was going to be a world record?
Yeah, absolutely. You were almost trained to do that as a track and field commentator. You look down at the time because you were thinking the world record probably is going to go in a race of this quality. And he left scorch marks. He really did. It wasn't the close finish that I'd feared, where I wondered who'd actually just got across the line first. It was clear who'd got across the line first. He shot out the blocks. He was always way clear. Lewis made up a little bit of ground in the closing stages. And what I was pleased about was I picked up the fact that Linford Christie came through and got the bronze medal for Britain, because that would have been a nasty moment. I didn't want a moment where David Coleman, the greatest athletics commentator ever, had it in 68, when he called David Hemery the winner and said, "Who cares who's third?" And it was John Sherwood from Sheffield.
So there must have been a certain amount of incredulity in the stadium when people looked at the clock and saw 9.79.
There was complete silence, actually, for a split second. There was complete silence.
Yeah.
Utter disbelief amongst 90-odd thousand people. And then there was a cheer. There was a palpable pause, a palpable collective intake of breath, and then it was hysteria.
The other thing I remember about that race was, and how much attention was on it, was in the seconds before, about 5 minutes before the race, the stadium was half empty. When the athletes came out and started taking off their tracksuits, as if from nowhere, the place just filled up within 2 minutes to be bursting at the seams. Where were they all beforehand? They certainly weren't watching the other events, but I'll tell you what, nobody was going to miss that.
They were all eating kimchi. That's my other memory of a soul, that every meal, every restaurant you went to, wherever it was, "Do you want kimchi?" First couple of days, "Yeah, I think I'll have some of that." A couple of weeks later, "No, I think I'll pass, actually, if you don't mind," because it was everywhere.
Do you remember as well, John, that the way they beat the traffic problems in Seoul? Because everybody said the Olympics won't be able to happen because the city would just be completely snarled up. And they, the, They just said, I'll tell you what we're going to do. If you've got an odd number car, you can drive one day. And if you've got an even number registration plate, you can drive the next day. Everyone else is banned. And everything flowed. But also, what
a great way to boost the car industry in Korea, because people then went and bought second cars that had an odd or an even number, depending on what their other car had. So it was a genius way of giving a massive, great boost to the car industry instantly.
Back to the aftermath then. Let's fast forward 48 hours once more. You've all been woken in the night. You're in your pyjamas, which is, I suppose, why everyone back here remembered Des Lynam breaking the news, because it would have been prime time, wouldn't it? Prime time on the TV. What then happened? Did it descend into utter chaos in Seoul?
Sean, I think you went to the press conference where they talked about the Stan Ozolol, didn't you?
Yeah.
I was just doing, all I remember is I was doing phone-ins and two ways all through the next day, and I don't think I slept for probably the best part of 24 hours.
It was the first time I'd ever experienced complete media frenzy like that. And the world, you know, people always say, oh, the world was watching. Well, actually, the world was watching and the world was there. And just to be in the hub of this, in the heart of this hub of media freneticism, was quite scary, actually. I didn't know where to go, what to do, who was I supposed to interview? And then this solitary IOC figure comes out and utters the word Stan Ozolol, which has now obviously passed into the lexicon of sporting dictionary. And everybody was suddenly looking up saying, what is it? What does it do? But it did. It started a train running that didn't really stop throughout the whole of the games. It was almost like irrespective of what else happened over the course of the next fortnight, it couldn't possibly touch the extraordinary events of that Saturday night and then obviously what happened subsequently. And you could argue, I mean, the fact that we're talking about it now and we remember it so well, it still is there in the pantheon of great, in inverted commas, Olympic moments. It's still there. It's still there right at the top because of the repercussions and the shockwaves it sent throughout the whole sporting world. And it really is, for all the wrong reasons, one of the great I was there moments that sadly, really, Ian and I both shared.
Yeah, because later, John, you remember we actually had a race on the track when the Olympics was over, the BBC
a
team.
A bit slower, though, Ian.
Not in 9.79 seconds, though.
Not rocket fuel.
No. Well, it was 9.79, but it was over 20 metres. That was the difference.
More like 19.79, I think. Did you win? You might have won.
No, I came second, but I can't remember who.
It wasn't Ron Jones.
I've banished it.
It wasn't Jeff Stelling. I don't know what happened to Jeff Stelling.
No idea what happened to him. Yeah.
Ian, it's been an absolute pleasure. Who'd have thought when you were interviewing Jack Nicholson ringside at the 1984 Olympics that 30 years later you would have a chant named after you in the USA? What is it? Ian the Yank? For your work on ESPN?
I'm not being modest or humble. I'm not aware of the chant. Because I've commentated on the... I should explain. I've commentated on the USA at a couple of World Cups, and I commentated on a big golden moment they had. So they've... I've been lucky they've kind of adopted me. Of course, anywhere else in the world, all you get is a load of criticism and Twitter trolls just trying to destroy you. But in the USA, I've been lucky. I'm actually quite liked by most of the fans. That'll probably change sometime soon too. But it's nice.
Thank you, Ian.
Pleasure to talk to you both.
We love you all.
Great. That was so fantastic. Thank you, gentlemen, very much.
Thank you, John.
Cheers, Darky.
There you go. Ian Dark, one of the great broadcasters this country has known over the last few decades. Isn't it great, John, that he's still front and centre on our football coverage thanks to his work on BT? Long may that continue.
Well, Jonathan, if you can allow me one story. Ian Dark is one of the great broadcasters, genuinely, that in my lifetime. And the very first ever football match I was sent to do by the BBC was at Upton Park to get West Ham against, I can't remember who it was against. And I was a bit nervous about going to do it. I'd done it on local radio, you know, interminably, but suddenly I was on national radio for the first time. And Ian was the only other person in the office as I was heading out to Upton Park. And because, you know, nowadays there'd be 500 people there, but in those days there were about three. And I said, Ian, what advice have you got for me? And he just said to me, you'll have 40 seconds to speak. Make sure that one line in there is really, really good. There is absolutely no excuse for ever doing a 40-second voice piece and not having one really good line. And I've never forgotten that. And so here we are. That was 1985. So here we are, 35 years later. I can still remember him giving me that piece of advice. So, Darkie, thank you.
Yes, great advice. Thank you, Ian. And thanks to you, John, as well, for being with us. I'm sure our good friend Matthew Allen would want to say thank you. Hello, Matthew, because he will have produced both yourself and Ian on location on many occasions over the years. Well, that was episode 3 of this brand new podcast, Sport in the Fields. If you've missed the first 2 episodes, subscribe now and you'll get them delivered straight to your podcast provider. And then you'll get a new episode, well, for the next couple of weeks, for every day of full competition at what would have been Tokyo 2020.
Sport in the Fields is a 94.19 independent production.
In association with Aldi UK, official supermarket partner of Team GB.